Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are soaring into, well, what many consider the ultimate symbol of American presidential power, the Flying White House. It's really a topic that carries immense history, some pretty cutting-edge technology, and frankly, a fascinating, almost unimaginable level of logistical complexity. Our mission today is to take the specific source material you shared with us and really dive deep into the details. We'll cover the plane's history, the official rules around its use, and the, you know, highly customized technology that makes the current presidential plane basically a command center in the sky. Okay, let's unpack this.
Right. And I think the first thing, the absolute essential place to start, is clarifying something that gets mixed up all the time.
Yeah.
What exactly is Air Force One?
Okay.
Because it's not actually the name of a specific airplane. It's the official air traffic control, ATC, call sign. And it applies to any U.S. Air Force aircraft that happens to be carrying the incumbent president of the United States at that moment.
That's such a critical distinction, isn't it? So theoretically, if the president, for some reason, hopped onto a standard C-17 cargo plane.
Exactly. That C-17 becomes Air Force One for that specific flight, just for that duration.
It's a temporary status then.
It is. And that's why the term has sort of become a metonym, you know, a shorthand, for the plane we usually see acting as Air Force One. That's the highly customized Boeing VC-25A.
VC-25A. What does that designation actually mean?
V is for VIP transport, C for cargo passenger capabilities. It's Model 25, and A is the specific variant. But even that specific plane, the VC-25A, it only uses the Air Force One call sign when the president is physically on board.
Otherwise,
it flies under a different designation. Usually SAM, that special air mission, followed by its tail number, like SAM 28,000 or SAM 29,000.
And the reason for this unique, very specific call sign, it actually stems from a safety incident.
Right.
A near miss.
A very serious mid-air safety scare, yes. Mm. This was back in 1954. President Eisenhower was flying on a Lockheed Constellation, and its flight number was 8610.
Okay.
The problem was there was a commercial Eastern Airlines flight in the same airspace at the same time with the exact same flight number, 8610.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Not good. Not good at all. Air traffic control apparently got confused just for a moment, but long enough to cause serious alarm. Imagine the potential consequences.
I can only imagine the reaction from the Secret Service and the Air Force. Probably immediate panic.
Immediate panic and an immediate fix. They realized they needed something completely unique, something that could never, ever be confused with any other flight, military or civilian.
And that's when Air Force One was created.
Precisely. A unique, unambiguous designation specifically for the president's Air Force transport.
Okay, so let's rewind a bit. How did presidents even start flying? We hear about Teddy Roosevelt in that early Wright flyer.
Right, 1910. But he was actually out of office by then. A cool footnote, but not presidential travel per se.
So the first sitting president to fly was
Franklin D. Roosevelt. And initially, it seems it was less about preference and more about, well, necessity later on. Yeah. His very first dedicated aircraft, acquired around 1933, was a Douglas Dolphin amphibian. The Navy called it an RD-2.
An amphibian, like lands on water? Exactly. And it was modified, sure, with some luxury upholstery, a separate sleeping area. But it was treated more like a, you know, a special yacht than a critical piece of government infrastructure early on.
But if he had that early plane, why did the military get involved later to create these really purpose-built aircraft? What changed?
World War II changed everything. Suddenly, transatlantic travel by sea became incredibly dangerous because of German U-boats. It was just too risky for the commander-in-chief.
Makes sense.
So when Roosevelt needed to go to the Casablanca Conference in 1943, he actually flew on a Pan Am Boeing 314 flying boat, the famous Dixie Clipper.
A commercial flight, essentially.
Yes, operated by Pan Am. And you can imagine the military and security advisors were, let's say, deeply uncomfortable relying on a civilian airline for that kind of high-stakes wartime transport.
Yeah, that seems like a huge security vulnerability. So that pushed the need for dedicated, military-controlled presidential planes.
That was the catalyst. They needed something purpose-built, secure, and under military control. Their first idea, actually, was a modified C-87A Liberator Express.
But that didn't happen.
No, it was rejected. It was derived from the B-24 bomber, which had a bit of a controversial safety record at the time, so they pivoted pretty quickly.
To what?
To converting a Douglas C-54 Skymaster, much more robust, reliable platform. This was in 1944.
And this became the famous Sacred Cow.
That's the one.
Oh, wait.
VC-54C Skymaster, officially. And it had some really specific modifications tailored directly for FDR.
Like the elevator, right? remember reading about that.
Exactly. That's the most remarkable feature. Roosevelt, of course, relied heavily on a wheelchair. Standard planes just weren't accessible. So they built this retractable, battery-powered elevator right into the fuselage.
Wow.
It was designed specifically to lift him and his wheelchair into the aircraft. Pretty amazing engineering for 1945.
Absolutely groundbreaking. Yeah. Any other key features?
It also included an early version of a radio telephone. This allowed him some capability to communicate securely while airborne, which was a huge step forward for, you know, command and control on the move.
So it was already about more than just transport. It was about enabling governance from the air.
That's the key shift, I think. Interestingly, Roosevelt himself only flew on the Sacred Cow once for the trip to the Yalta Conference in February 1945, not long before he passed away.
Only once. But its legacy is huge.
Immense! Because President Harry S. Truman inherited it. And it was aboard the Sacred Cow that Truman later signed the National Security Act of 1947.
The act that created the U.S. Air Force itself.
The very same act, signed on the first purpose-built presidential aircraft. You can't get much more historic than that.
That plane is just steeped in history. So Truman used the Sacred Cow for a bit, then got his own plane.
He did. In 1947, he replaced it with a C-118 Liftmaster, which he personally named Independence, after his hometown there in Missouri.
The Independence. Did it have any unique features?
It sort of reflected that post-war American confidence. It had a proper stateroom, could seat about 24 people, and maybe most famously, its nose was painted to look like the head of a bald eagle.
Very patriotic.
Very much so. A clear symbol. And for anyone interested, the Independence is actually preserved. You can see it at the National Museum of the United States Air Force in Dayton, Ohio.
Good to know. Then came Eisenhower, and he introduced propeller planes, too, the Constellations.
That's right. Eisenhower's era saw four propeller planes used, including two famous Lockheed Constellations, Columbine II and Columbine III. First Lady Mamie Eisenhower named them after the Colorado state flower.
And Columbine II was the plane involved in that near miss we talked about, the one that led to the Air Force One call sign.
Correct. So it holds that piece of history. But as we established, the propeller era, well, its days were numbered, especially on the world stage.
Right. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the Cold War context became really important here, didn't it?
Yeah.
Speed mattered.
It became a matter of national image, even dignity. This brings us to that famous story about Secretary of State John Foster Dulles.
What did he say?
Well, the story goes that Dulles observed the Soviet leaders, Khrushchev in particular, zipping around in these advanced long-range Tupolev Tu-114 jets, big, fast, impressive aircraft.
While the U.S. president was still in propeller planes.
Exactly. Dulles reportedly argued it was, quote, undignified for the American president to be using slower technology while the Soviets were showcasing these modern jets. It was part of the technological and psychological competition of the Cold War playing out right there on the tarmac.
That kind of pressure.
Yeah.
It must have had an immediate effect.
It did. The Air Force moved quickly to procure jets. They acquired three Boeing 707-120s, which were designated VC-137. We know them by their special air mission numbers, SAM 970, 971, and 972.
And the difference in capability must have been staggering.
Transformative. Eisenhower took his famous Flight to Peace Goodwill tour in late 1959. He covered something like 22,000 miles in just 19 days. That kind of itinerary would have been physically exhausting, maybe even impossible, with the older propeller planes like the Columbines. Jet travel just shrank the globe overnight, dramatically boosting diplomatic capacity.
Interestingly, it wasn't Eisenhower who first used one officially.
No, technically, Vice President Richard Nixon was the first high-profile user. He took a VC-137A on his trip to Russia in 1959. That's when the famous kitchen debates with Khrushchev happened. Eisenhower first flew via jet a bit later that same month on SAM 970, which had the nickname Queenie.
So they solved the speed problem, but the look wasn't quite right yet.
Not according to some very influential eyes. They had the jet power, but the image needed an upgrade. Here's where it gets really interesting.
This is about the livery, right?
Yeah.
The iconic blue and white design we all recognize.
Absolutely. The visual identity of Air Force One. When John F. Kennedy took office, the next new primary presidential jet was being prepared, a VC-137C, which would become SAM 26,000.
And First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy got involved.
She did. She apparently wasn't thrilled with the existing military look of the planes. On her recommendation, they reached out to Raymond Loewy.
The famous industrial designer.
Yeah.
The guy who did the Coca-Cola bottle logos.
That's him. A giant of 20th century design. And remarkably, he offered his services completely free of charge. He saw it as a contribution.
Why did he feel so strongly about redesigning it? What was wrong with the existing look?
Lowy's own word for the look of Sam 970 with its rather prominent orange nose and military markings was apparently garish.
Garish. Oh.
He felt it looked too much like just another military transport. It lacked, in his view, the unique dignity, the modernity, the kind of global statement appropriate for the president of the United States. He wanted something aspirational, instantly recognizable.
So what did he change? What are the key elements he introduced that created that jet age optimism look?
He fundamentally reimagined the plane's visual language. His initial sketches actually included a red and gold scheme, but President Kennedy himself preferred blue.
JFK chose the blue.
He expressed a preference for blue based on one of Lowy's options. That gave Lowy the direction he needed. He then selected two specific shades of blue, a kind of slate blue, a steel blue, which he felt connected to the early Republic, and a more contemporary, lighter cyan or water blue.
So the colors themselves were meant to evoke history and the present.
Exactly. But maybe the most inspired touch, the real aha moment, came from an unexpected source.
Which was?
Lowy was apparently looking at a copy, perhaps the first printed copy, of the Declaration of Independence.
No kidding.
Yes. And that's what inspired the typeface for the main legend along the fuselage, United States of America. He chose Caslon, a very classic strong typeface, and spaced the uppercase letters widely. It just gave it this instant sense of authority, history, and clarity.
And the polished bottom, that's Lowy too.
Absolutely, that was key to the sleekness. Instead of painting the whole massive fuselage, he left the bottom portion as exposed, highly polished aluminum. This created this strong horizontal line, emphasizing speed and modernity, contrasting beautifully with the blues above.
Add the presidential seal near the nose, the big flag on the tail.
And there you have it. That design just captured the moment perfectly. It became the standard, and it's still the foundation, really, for the Air Force One livery we see today.
It's truly iconic. Now, that plane, Sam 26,000, and its successor, Sam 27,000, they weren't just beautiful designs. They witnessed some incredible history.
Oh, absolutely. Sam 26,000. That plane was the backdrop for some of the most pivotal moments of the late 20th century. It entered service in 1962 and flew presidents from Kennedy all the way through Clinton. It wasn't retired until 1998.
It saw the highs of Camelot and then Dallas.
The assassination in November 1963 is inextricably linked to Sam 26,000. It flew President Kennedy to Dallas Love Field. And then just hours later, it was on the tarmac there that Lyndon B. Johnson took the oath of office aboard the aircraft.
The only time a president has been sworn in on a plane.
The only time. It became the immediate secure location for that crucial transfer of power before flying back to Washington, D.C. And then, fulfilling a different solemn duty, it carried LBJ's body back home to Texas after his state funeral in 1973. It was truly a witness to the full circle of that presidency.
But it wasn't just tragedy. It was also a platform for groundbreaking diplomacy, wasn't it?
Hugely important. Sam 26,000 was the aircraft that carried President Nixon on those absolutely historic trips in 1972. First, the opening of relations with the People's Republic of China, and then the summit in the Soviet Union later that year. Those flights changed the world.
Nixon even gave it a nickname for a while.
He did. For the bicentennial, he dubbed it the Spirit of 76 and had that logo temporarily added to the nose.
So Sam 26,000 had an incredibly long service life, even after its replacement arrived.
Right. Sam 27,000, another VC-137C, took over as the primary presidential aircraft in December 1972, but 26,000 stayed on as the main backup until 98. Sam 27,000 then served presidents from Nixon through George W. Bush.
And Sam 27,000 had its own share of drama, including that incident with Syrian fighters.
A very tense moment, yes. June 1974, flying over Syria, Air Force One was intercepted by Syrian MiG fighter jets. Apparently without any prior warning or coordination, they were ostensibly there to act as escorts, but the sudden appearance
must have been terrifying for the crew.
Extremely. The Air Force One crew took immediate evasive action, including a sharp dive, because they didn't know the MiG's intentions. It really highlights the kind of constant, unpredictable threat environment these planes operate in.
But the most sort of symbolically powerful moment involving Sam 27,000 has to be during Nixon's resignation.
Oh, absolutely. That sequence of events perfectly illustrates the call sign rule we started with. Nixon announced his resignation, then boarded Sam 27,000 to fly back to California. At that point, it was still using the call sign Air Force One.
But only until Ford was sworn in.
Exactly. While Nixon was literally in the air flying over Missouri, Gerald Ford took the oath of office back in Washington. At that precise moment, the aircraft carrying Nixon was no longer carrying the incumbent president.
And the pilot had to make that famous radio call.
Colonel Ralph Albertazzi did. He contacted the air traffic control tower near Jefferson City, Missouri. And his words were so precise, so historic. Kansas City, this was Air Force One. Will you change our call sign to Sierra Alpha Mike 27,000?
Wow. The call sign changed mid-flight.
Instantly. A single event on the ground changed the official identity of the aircraft thousands of feet above. It perfectly encapsulates that the call sign follows the office, not the individual or the hardware.
That immediate transfer of status really brings us to the modern fleet, the Boeing VC-25As. These planes are on a whole different level, aren't they? A true logistical and technological superpower.
They really are. The current pair, SAM 28000 and SAM 29000, these highly customized Boeing 747-200 beans, have been in service since 1990. They were actually ordered back in the Reagan administration.
Why the move to the 747?
Yeah.
What prompted that big upgrade from the 707s?
Primarily, it was range, capacity, and the need for redundancy. The 707s were aging, and presidential travel demands were increasing. The Air Force set requirements that basically necessitated a larger plane. They needed a minimum unrefueled range of 6,000 miles.
Okay.
And critically, a minimum of 3 engines for safety over long ocean routes, though the 747 obviously has 4. The sheer size of the 747-200B platform also allowed for the integration of much more sophisticated communications, office space, and essentially a flying command center.
Enabling the president to govern from anywhere, 24/7.
That's the idea. And these VC-25As are far more than just transport. They are mobile fortresses.
Let's dive into some of those capabilities. What makes them so special beyond just being big?
Well, we're talking about roughly 4,000 square feet of interior floor space. Think about that. It's basically a multi-level executive suite in the sky, but the key is the hardening in the systems.
Hardening? Against what?
Against various threats. The aircraft is shielded to protect its crucial electronic systems from the effects of an electromagnetic pulse, or EMP, like one generated by a nuclear detonation.
So communications would still work after a nuclear blast.
That's the design goal. It also possesses advanced electronic countermeasures, ECM systems. These are designed to jam enemy radar, confuse incoming missile guidance systems. Basically, sophisticated electronic self-defense.
Okay, so it's protected. What about its function as an actual office, a command post?
That's where the communication suite comes in. It's incredibly advanced. Multiple secure satellite communication channels, encrypted telephones, data links, all designed to be jam-proof. The president can securely communicate with military leaders, government officials, anyone, anywhere in the world, in real time.
Like the White House Situation Room, but mobile.
Essentially, yes. It's designed so the president could, if necessary, direct military operations from the air without any loss of command capability.
Amazing. And the interior layout reflects this dual role.
Absolutely. There's the presidential suite itself, which includes an office often compared to a mini Oval Office, a conference room, and private living quarters. But maybe one of the most critical features is the onboard medical facility.
A doctor travels on board.
Always. And the medical suite is basically a flying emergency room. It includes an operating table, emergency medical supplies. It's equipped to handle significant medical emergencies right there in the air.
That's incredible foresight. And with potentially over 100 people on board staff, Secret Service, press pool, how do they handle food?
Not with prepackaged sandwiches. The VC-25A has 2 fully equipped galleys. They function like high-end restaurant kitchens, capable of preparing and serving gourmet meals for everyone on board, even on the longest flights.
So it's a self-contained ecosystem, but it rarely travels alone, does it? This brings us to the massive logistical footprint.
Right. If we connect this to the bigger picture, Air Force One itself is just the tip of the spear, really. It's always the center of this enormous logistical bubble.
What do you mean by bubble?
Well, for almost any presidential trip, especially overseas, a whole fleet of support aircraft flies ahead, sometimes days or even weeks in advance. We're talking up to 6 massive cargo planes, usually C-17 Globemaster 3s, or the even larger C-5 Galaxies.
And what are they carrying that requires huge military cargo jets?
Everything the president might need on the ground, transported securely. This includes the presidential limousine, the Beast, and often a backup limo, too. It includes specialized communications vehicles. It includes Marine Corps helicopters like the Sikorsky, VH-60, and White Hawks for short hops.
So they fly in the helicopters, too?
Oh, yes. Plus, hundreds of personnel, Secret Service agents, military support staff, maintenance crews for Air Force One, communications specialists. The list goes on. It's a massive deployment just to support one arrival.
And what about refueling? Could the VC-25A refuel in midair?
Yes, it has that capability, though it's rarely needed given its long range. But more importantly, for longer or more sensitive trips, they often deploy Air Force refueling tankers, like the KC-10 extender or the KC-46 Pegasus.
Why, if it has a range?
Control. It ensures that Air Force One doesn't have to land and take on fuel from a source that hasn't been thoroughly vetted and secured by U.S. personnel. It maintains the integrity of that security bubble, even for something as basic as fuel.
That level of control, that constant threat assessment, it became terrifyingly real on September 11th, 2001.
Absolutely. The experience of Air Force One on 9/11 is a stark reminder of why all these systems and protocols exist. President George W. Bush was in Florida when the attacks happened and took off from Sarasota aboard a VC-25A piloted by Colonel Mark Tillman.
And things got tense very quickly in the air, didn't they?
Almost immediately. Air traffic control was in chaos. Colonel Tillman described getting a warning from Jacksonville Center ATC about another jet nearby. It wasn't responding to radio calls, its transponder was off, and it appeared to be descending towards them into their restricted airspace.
A direct threat, potentially.
That was the immediate fear. They didn't know if it was another hijacked plane, maybe sent to track or intercept Air Force One.
What did Colonel Tillman do? How do you react to that?
Tactically, he requested permission to deviate from their flight plan and took the plane out over the Gulf of Mexico, making an unscheduled turn. His thinking was, if this other plane was following them, this maneuver would reveal it.
Did it follow?
Thankfully, no. It continued on its previous course. It was later determined to be just a regular airliner that had unfortunately lost its transponder signal at the worst possible moment. But in that moment, the threat felt entirely real.
And then came another, even more specific warning.
Yes. A coded message came through indicating a specific threat against Air Force One itself. The message apparently warned that Angel was next.
Angel.
Angel was, and likely still is, the classified internal call sign or code name for Air Force One. Receiving that message meant someone, somewhere, believed the president's plane was now a specific target.
So returning to Washington, D.C. was out of the question.
Absolutely. The Secret Service and military advisors decided against returning to Andrews Air Force Base. They were concerned about the possibility of an attack on the ground there or even during the approach. The risk was deemed too high.
So where did they go?
They diverted, first landing at Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana. President Bush made brief remarks there. Then they took off again and flew to Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska, home of U.S. Strategic Command. It was about keeping the president secure and airborne, or at secure military locations, until the situation was clearer.
It's interesting. The White House initially said there was specific and credible information about the threat, but later reports suggested it might have been miscommunication.
Right. Subsequent investigations, including the 9/11 Commission report, suggested that the original Angel is Next threat likely stemmed from confusion and miscommunication within the government and intelligence channels during those chaotic first hours. But regardless of the ultimate validity of that specific warning, the response by Colonel Tillman and the decisions made demonstrate the VC-25A's crucial role. It functioned exactly as intended, a secure mobile command post capable of evasive action during a national emergency.
That day certainly proved the value of the investment. But even these incredible planes get old. Which brings us to the replacement program, the VC-25B.
Exactly. The current VC-25As, SAM 28,000 and 29,000, are now over 30 years old. For complex aircraft like these, that's getting up there. Maintenance becomes increasingly complex and expensive.
And the engines are less efficient than modern ones.
Significantly. They use older General Electric CF6 engines. Modern jets offer much better fuel efficiency and lower operating costs. At this point, the sheer cost of maintaining the aging Sub-47-200Bs is starting to outweigh the cost of acquiring and modifying new planes. It's just becoming economically sensible to replace them.
So the Air Force chose the Boeing 747-8 as the replacement platform back in 2015.
Yeah.
That's the newest version of the 747, right?
Correct. The 747-8 Intercontinental. It's slightly larger, more fuel-efficient, longer range. Just the next generation of that iconic airframe.
And the price tag for these two new planes is pretty hefty.
It is. The total projected cost for the VC-25B program, including the extensive modifications needed, is currently estimated at nearly $4 billion. The deliveries are now scheduled for 2027 and 2028, a bit later than originally planned.
There was an interesting wrinkle in how they acquired the actual airframes, wasn't there? They weren't built new for the Air Force.
That's right. In a move to try and save costs, the Air Force actually purchased two 747-8s that had already been built by Boeing but were never delivered. They were originally ordered by a Russian airline called Transaero, which went bankrupt.
So they got effectively brand new planes just sitting there.
Essentially, yes. White tails, as they're sometimes called in the industry. Already built, but without a buyer.
And the acquisition process, especially under President Trump, led to that whole debate about the livery, the paint scheme.
Yes, the livery saga. President Trump got personally involved in renegotiating the contract with Boeing, threatening cancellation at one point. He also expressed a strong desire to change the classic Raymond Loewy design.
He wanted something different.
He proposed a new patriotic color scheme. It would have featured a prominent deep red stripe down the side, replacing the blues, and a dark, almost navy blue underbelly instead of the polished aluminum.
A pretty radical departure. Why didn't it happen?
Ultimately, the proposed design was scrapped. There were several reasons cited, including potential engineering concerns. Some reports suggested the dark blue paint on the underside might absorb more heat, potentially impacting the thermal management of sensitive electronic components housed there, and possibly adding weight and cost.
So tradition won out in the end.
Mostly, yes. In March 2023, the Air Force officially unveiled the livery for the new VC-25Bs. It's essentially a modernized take on the classic Loewy design, keeping the recognizable slate and cyan blues, the polished belly or paint color closely mimicking it, and the Kazlon typeface. A few subtle tweaks, but very much honoring the original.
Looking even further ahead, the idea of a supersonic Air Force One sounds like something out of a movie, but it's actually being explored.
It is, quite seriously. It's moving beyond just concepts. The Air Force Presidential and Executive Airlift Directorate, the office responsible for these planes, has actually awarded contracts to several aerospace companies, names like Exasonic, Hermes, Boom Supersonic,
What are these contracts for?
to develop and study the feasibility of a supersonic executive transport. We're talking about potentially flying the president at speeds maybe up to Mach 5, 5 times the speed of sound.
Mach 5. It's incredibly fast. How would that change things?
Fundamentally, I think. Imagine being able to respond to a crisis on the other side of the world in just a few hours instead of 12 or 15. It could completely rewrite the timelines for diplomacy, for crisis response. You could potentially attend meetings on multiple continents in a single day.
But the challenges must be immense.
Colossal. You have the technological hurdles of sustained high Mach flight. You have the environmental concerns. The sonic boom over populated areas is a major issue. You have the sheer fuel consumption. And then how do you adequately protect and secure an aircraft traveling at those speeds? How do you maintain secure communications? It opens up a whole new realm of complexities.
It's fascinating to think about. Now, speaking of complex aircraft acquisitions, we have to touch on that Boeing 747-8 that was accepted as a gift from Qatar.
Ah, yes, that was quite a story back in May 2025. The Trump administration formally accepted this brand new Boeing 747-8 from the royal family of Qatar. Its estimated value was around $400 million.
$400 million. That must be one of the most valuable foreign gifts ever received by the U.S. government.
By far, yes. The reporting at the time indicated it was the most valuable ever.
So a free 747-8. Why not just modify that one to become the next Air Force One? Seems like a bargain.
Well, free is relative when you factor in what's needed next. The controversy or complexity arises because turning a standard commercial 747-8 into a plane meeting the extreme security and communication standards of a VC-25B is an incredibly complex and expensive process.
It needs all that hardening, the special systems.
Exactly. The secure comms, the EMP protection, the countermeasures, the medical suite, the reinforced structure, all of that has to be custom engineered and installed. It's not just adding some nice seats. And the estimates were that these modifications would take years, likely not being completed until well after 2028, when the other two VC-25Ds are scheduled to be delivered.
So it wouldn't actually speed up the replacement process.
No, probably the opposite. And there was another layer of complexity, too, concerning the legal nature of the transfer itself.
What was that about?
While it was publicly presented as a straightforward, unconditional gift, sources later noted that Qatar apparently required the U.S. to sign a memorandum. This memorandum essentially confirmed that the U.S. had initiated the transfer request.
Why would Qatar need that?
It seems it was primarily for legal liability reasons on their end, possibly related to ensuring compliance with international laws around gifting military potential hardware and making sure they weren't seen as trying to improperly influence the U.S. government. This memorandum, shielding Qatar from liability, was reportedly signed in July 2025.
So even a free plane comes with a lot of strings, or at least paperwork.
A lot of very specific legal and logistical hurdles, yes. It highlights just how complex anything involving presidential transport becomes.
Okay, let's broaden the scope a bit. Air Force One is the most famous call sign, but there's a whole family of these special designations, right?
There are. The system is designed for clarity across different branches and situations. The second most famous is probably Air Force Two.
That's for the vice president.
Correct. It's the call sign used whenever the vice president is flying aboard any U.S. Air Force aircraft. And often, for longer international trips, the VP actually does use one of the VC-25As, or more commonly, the C-32 aircraft.
And then we see the helicopters all the time, especially around the White House. That's Marine One.
Right. Anytime the president is flying in a United States Marine Corps helicopter, the call sign is Marine One. They operate a dedicated squadron, HMX-1, with specially modified helicopters, usually Sikorsky VH-3D Sea Kings or the newer VH-92A Patriots.
Has there ever been a Navy One?
Only once, very famously. In May 2003, President George W. Bush wanted to land on the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln out in the Pacific. He actually flew in the co-pilot seat of a Navy S-3B Viking jet for the carrier landing. For that specific flight, the aircraft used the unique call sign Navy One.
The mission accomplished moment.
That's the one. And then there's the designation for when a president flies on a civilian aircraft.
Which seems incredibly rare.
Extremely rare today, almost unthinkable from a security perspective. But it has happened. The call sign is Executive One.
Has it ever actually been used?
Yes. United Airlines holds the unique distinction. Back in December 1973, during the height of the energy crisis, President Nixon and his family flew commercially on a United Airlines DC-10 from Washington Dulles to Los Angeles. It was presented as an effort to conserve fuel.
Wow. Flying commercial as president. Hard to imagine now.
Completely different era. United is the only commercial airline ever to have operated a flight with the Executive One call sign.
We also need to talk about the other jets in the fleet, the ones that aren't the massive 747s. They play important roles too, right? Like decoys or for smaller airports.
Absolutely. The Air Force maintains a fleet of Boeing C-32A aircraft. These are modified Boeing 757's narrow-body jets. They're often used by the vice president as Air Force Two, the first lady, cabinet secretary.
But the president uses them sometimes too.
Yes, particularly when flying into airports with shorter runways that can't easily accommodate the huge VC-25A. Or, importantly, when increased secrecy or a lower profile is desired.
Like the trip President Biden took to Ukraine.
That's a perfect example. In February 2023, for his surprise visit to Kyiv via Poland, President Biden flew on a C-32. Using the less conspicuous 757 and likely flying under a standard special air mission call sign like SAM-060 for part of the journey, helped maintain secrecy and avoided the instant global attention that tracking the known Air Force One 747s would bring.
And there have been times when they've used actual decoy tactics, right? Multiple planes.
Yes. That's been employed in high-threat environments. President Bill Clinton used this strategy, for instance, during his visit to Pakistan in 2000. Reports indicated he actually flew aboard a smaller, unmarked Gulfstream III jet for part of the journey.
While another Air Force plane flew nearby.
Exactly. While another Air Force aircraft flew the same route, possibly even using the Air Force One call sign, essentially acting as a visible decoy to draw attention away from the actual aircraft carrying the president. It's about maximizing confusion for any potential adversaries.
And just one more fun historical one. LBJ needed a special small plane for his Texas ranch.
Huh? Yes. The necessities of Texas geography. President Johnson loved spending time at his ranch, but its runway was too short for the big Boeing 707, SAM 26,000 at the time.
So how did he get there?
He'd fly the 707 into the larger Bergstrom Air Force Base near Austin. Then he transferred to a much smaller Lockheed VC-140B Jetstar for the short hop to the ranch's airstrip. That little Jetstar was sometimes affectionately nicknamed Ladybird's airplane. So when you look back at the whole history, you really see this constant evolution. It started with modifying existing planes for comfort, like FDR's amphibian or the Sacred Cow with its elevator. Then came the jet age, speed, the iconic Lowy design defining the image. And finally, we arrive at today's VC-25A, not just a plane, but this incredibly complex, hardened, globally supported command center. It went from luxury transport to a critical instrument of national security and power projection. But the constant thread, the most important takeaway, I think, is that the call sign, Air Force One, signifies the presidency being aboard an Air Force asset. The specific plane is secondary to the status and security protocols that instantly surround that call sign. The call sign truly is everything.
It really is remarkable. Tracing that journey from, you know, modified planes dealing with World War II necessity all the way to this multi-billion-dollar globe-spanning operation designed purely to move the presidents safely and keep them connected. It's staggering, the sheer level of customization, the layers of security, the logistical planning involved. It really underscores the unique and extraordinary demands placed on the modern presidency, doesn't it? But as you said, the evolution isn't stopping. We have the new VC-25Bs coming online soon, which modernize the current capability. But that glimpse into the future, the work being done on supersonic presidential transport, it really sparks the imagination. So here's something to think about. If the president could travel at Mach 5, five times the speed of sound, slashing travel times dramatically, how might that fundamentally alter the way diplomacy is conducted or how the U.S. responds to global crises in real time? And conversely, what new kinds of challenges, maybe security vulnerabilities we haven't even conceived of yet, or complex logistical demands related to that sheer speed might such a capability introduce? It really makes you wonder what the next chapter of presidential travel might look like.